I introduce Gene Dean.
He's still on Valium. My name is Gene, and I, too, am an alcoholic. And I'd certainly be remiss before I talk to not thank the committee for inviting me to this very enchanting place. I have never been here before. And I was out this morning about 5:45, taking in the sunrise, as a few others were, and I was standing down the road here looking up at that big rock up there, and some hippie-type looking guy came up alongside, had a big hat on, looked like old Death Valley Joe or something, you know, and he must have been short of cigarettes because he was smoking one. He was holding it like that. And he said, "Hey, partner," he said, "you're looking at the eighth wonder of the world." I just looked at him and I said, "You're looking at the ninth." And I said, "If you hang around, I'll show you the 10th, 11th, 12th, 13th, and right on up, you know." I got up here yesterday and got all messed up right off the bat. I was in the lobby of the hotel, and they told me you had to come way over here to go to the meeting. And I said, "How do I get over there?" I said, "Go out in front and get on the bus." And I was sitting on the bus for about 20 minutes, and I was wondering why everybody was talking German. It was the tour bus going back to Fresno, you know. But I finally made it, and here we are. When I say I'm an alcoholic, I base that definition how I interpret the definition of the word alcoholic, as it's defined in the third chapter of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, wherein it says that we alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. And it doesn't say anything about how much you drank, what you drank, or how long you drank, or that in order to qualify for membership in AA or identify as an alcoholic, you have to spend time in prisons, jails, institutions, be divorced a couple of times, marry the same woman twice, and do all sorts of silly things like that. It just says that somewhere along the line we have to come face to face with ourselves in what we hope is a state of complete honesty as to whether or not we can accept the fact that we as alcoholics have lost that ability to control our drinking. I found that rather difficult because I came to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 24 years old. And I was 6 years obtaining my first year of full sobriety because I could not accept the fact that I had lost that ability to control my drinking. One of the men that was working with me in those days told me that losing that ability was similar to losing your virginity. Once it's gone, you know. But like so many other people, even applying to my virginity, I tried to have others think I still had it, but I knew I didn't, you know. As a result of that, you know, I arrived at a point in my life where I'd done the exact thing that I was told to do. You know, many people who come to AA say they had difficulty in accepting the regimen, you know, and doing what they were told, following directions. I didn't have that trouble. As a matter of fact, the very first thing that was told to me in AA, I went out and did. Because I came here, as I say, when I was 24 years old, and I went to my first meeting in a little town called Dixon, Illinois, which is northwest of Chicago. And it was a speaker-type meeting or something, and I went there with that attitude that I wasn't an alcoholic, couldn't be an alcoholic, didn't want to be an alcoholic, and wouldn't be even if I was. And so I sat there with an entirely negative attitude during the whole meeting, and at that time I was a construction. I'm a stonemason by trade, or which I no longer have applied for many, many years. But this group was predominantly all construction workers, And after the meeting was over, I was walking out of this little community center where they had it. And there was an old iron worker foreman that I knew there by the name of McGinnis. And he was standing there by the door. And he and I had a personality clash all our lives. And as I walked by him, he said, "Hey, hot shot," he said, "that meeting mean anything to you?" And I said, "No." I says, "But it's a good place for assholes like you, you know." And he says, "Well, go on out and get yourself a story and then come back." And I did exactly what he said. I did exactly what he said, you know. I came back 6 years later and I made Muggs' drinking sound like he had spent most of his time in Disneyland, you know. And it certainly wasn't any goal or it wasn't any self-improvement project, you know. I, like you, never intended to be here. Never intended to be here. But as I was walking around out there this morning, you know, I was thinking how grateful I really am to be here. How grateful I really am, you know. And I sort of copped out to myself this morning a little bit. You know, when you're standing there, you can't help but feel a little bit humble in an atmosphere like this. And I was not only so thankful, you know, for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, but for the great adventure that AA is, you know, and the great adventure that sobriety is. And I stopped to reminisce and think of the places that I've been, you know, as a result of not having taken a drink and then wind up here in this eighth wonder of the world. I was just extremely almost overwhelmed, you know, at how fortunate I am. And it's because of that gratitude right now, I can stand here, you know, not sorry for anything that's ever taken place in my life. I'm grateful for every drink I ever took. I'm grateful for every kind of jail that I was ever in, every kind of prison that I ever had to go through. I'm grateful for living as an animal on Chicago Skid Row for a year and a half. I'm grateful for all of that obscenity, all of that stuff that's listed in the book as pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. Because obviously, all of that was necessary to bring me to, you know, Yosemite National Park on this Saturday morning, you know, with the same kind of people that are like me. I can think of no other place in the entire world or my life where I would rather be right now than here. And so all of that garbage was necessary to bring you and I here together. And for that, I am grateful, and I'm quite sure you are too. Because... As I was standing there, you know, watching that water come over the falls, I was thinking of, you know, the great things that nature has done, you know, and fantastic things. And I guess they're referred to as miracles. And often in AA, we are referred to as miracles. And many of you know that I have a lot of trouble with the English language, so I refer to the dictionary a lot, you know. And I'm always looking up words so I can get the full understanding of them. And so I looked up the word miracle, because I'd heard it so many times in AA, and it sure became evident here this morning, you know. The word miracle, as it's defined in most standard dictionaries, says that a miracle is any event or happening that defies or denies known scientific fact. And certainly each of us in this room has defied known scientific fact. I can't speak for you, I can only speak for myself. But there have been... on three occasions in my life, when men of medical science have notified my next of kin, wives, or whoever happened to be around at that time, you know, that I was about to die, that my lifespan was going to be measured now more or less in minutes or possibly in hours, that as a result of my abuse with alcohol, that life was going to terminate for me. On three occasions, men of science have said that. Men of religious science have lit little candles and sprinkled me with water and put out little sort of ornaments, you know, and said that my life was about to be over, too, you know. And yet here I am, and here you are, you know, the evidence that we have fulfilled the definition of the word miracle by denying and defying those known scientific facts, you know. I never intended to be an alcoholic, and I don't think anybody in this room ever intended to be an alcoholic. But as I just said, if I had it all to live over again, I'd want to do it the exact same way I did. Because that's what got me here. That's what got me here. And we are fortunate to be here. I spent a lot of time, you know, trying to find out why I was an alcoholic. Whether that's important or not, I don't know. It might be important to know why you're an alcoholic, because you might be able to use that knowledge to defend yourself against the possibility of taking a drink. And I said that to somebody at breakfast this morning. They said, "What do you mean a possibility of taking a drink?" They said, "Hell, you wouldn't take a drink now after all of these years." And I was like, "Hell, I wouldn't." I said, son, "You better remember this. We all walk with clay feet, you know, and I don't care how long you've been around here, you know, or how much you think you know. the possibility for us to take a drink is still out there, still out there. You know, a good example of that just happened at my home group the other night, and I go to a men's stag group in the Bay Area, which, if you're only sober 30 years, you have to put out the ashtrays, you know. It's that kind of a group. Jesus Christ, you know. And we were talking about different things and the possibility of us taking a drink. And there's a guy that sits... I want to show you how sick I still am, you know. We've been going to this group, all of us, so long that we all have our own seats, you know. If somebody happens to be in your seat, you... They give them that kind of crap, you know. And if they put the literature on the wrong side of the table, everybody gets upset about that, you know. And I've been sitting alongside of the same guy for years. His name is Orin. And I don't know if you got any Orins in your group, but this guy is probably keeping me sober because I hate him. He's one of them bullet pickers. You ever see a bullet picker? That's the guy that picks his nose, you know. He's about 41 years sober. And all he ever does is the meat, and he sits there like this. Now, that isn't so bad. But when he gets one, he rolls it. And he spends about 5 minutes doing that. And then he sort of looks around to see if anybody's looking. If nobody's looking, he goes, I'd like to kill him. I'd like to kill him. And he never really contributes anything positive to the meeting. You know, he's an old, old-timer, you know, real old, old-timer. And after everybody discusses things intellectually, you know, Orin puts his last 2 cents in because he's reserved the right to be the final commentator, you know. And he goes, you couldn't get me to take a drink for $1 million, you know. And I sit there wondering, you know, and sometimes I wonder about me, and I wonder about you, and I wonder about everybody in AA. Couldn't get me to take a drink for $1 million. Someday I want to be sitting alongside of Orin. When he makes that statement, then I'm going to go, here, split a bottle of beer with me. And I ask you this only to be answered to yourself, of course. But it might be good for you to answer this question truthfully, because it'll show you why we need meetings, why we need each other, and why we need this program. If you're sitting there smug in your sobriety, think for 1 minute. If the whole entire assemblage of Alcoholics Anonymous was here today, 1 million sober members of AA, and we're all sitting out here, and I said, I'll give anybody in this room $1 million if you'll come up here and split a bottle of beer with me. How would you answer? How would you answer? Now, I'm quite sure you know how you answer. Now you know why you go to meetings, see? And some of us would sell out for a hell of a lot cheaper than that. You want to try? I think we all become alcoholics for the same reason. A young lady touched on it last night there, and you hear people touching on it all the time, you know. A dissatisfaction with who we are at any given time, you know. I was dissatisfied with what I was when I was 16 years old. I'm a street kid from the Lower East Side of New York City. I was born and raised during what they refer to as the Great Depression. I'm the product of a broken home, you know, all of the things that psychiatrically I could use as the causes for my being an alcoholic, but none of them valid, of course. Growing up, I had a lot of problems, but I had no problems with booze. I had a lot of problems with cops when I was growing up. Because I was doing things, you know, that kids my age did in those days in order to survive or exist. I was in the hubcap business, spotlight business, and I wasn't beyond rolling a few priests or anybody else and things like that. Recreation, I call it, recreation. And in 1941, prior to World War II, a couple of detectives visited me in a little candy store that I was operating out of. And they took me to the federal building at 90 Church Street in mid-Manhattan. And they told me that before I left that building that day that one of two things was going to take place in my life. That I either was going to voluntarily enlist in some branch of the military, or I was going to be sentenced to a year and a day at Rikers Island, which in those days was New York City and County Juvenile Detention Facility. Now, I wouldn't want anybody in this room to think any foolish reasons like I'm a daredevil or I'm a patriotic son of a gun and interested in defending the homeland and womanhood and all of that. It just made more sense to me to go into the military than to go to a reform school for a year and a day, you know. Now, that was no big decision because that was prior, of course, to World War II. There wasn't even hardly any thought of war in those days. Sure, Great Britain and England and places, they were at war, but it was still a thing that we just talked about here. And so I entered the military. And what a mistake that was for a while, because some things happened to me, how ironic. Some things happened to me right off of the bat that could be applied later on in my life to my problem with alcoholism and my eventual recovery as of now from the problem of alcoholism. Because I think I discovered why I drank the very night that I went into the service. I enlisted underage in the United States Marines. And I was told that I was going to a place called Parris Island, South Carolina, to receive my training. Now, up until that time, I was nothing more than a street, snotty-ass, wise-ass punk kid. I hadn't even shaved yet. My entire world was about 40 square city blocks. I knew every rooftop, every alley, every basement, every manhole in them 40 square city blocks. But beyond that was all totally alien to me. I knew that there was a place on the other side of the Hudson River called New Jersey. I knew that if you went on up through the Bronx and into Westchester, you would eventually come to a place called Connecticut. But I had no idea where in the hell this place, South Carolina, was. I didn't know whether you flew there, walked there, took a boat or train or a car. And I thought if you got there, you had to start shooting Indians because outside of New York was all Indians, all Indians. That night, I got put on a train with six other guys who had also enlisted in the Marines that day. But they were old guys, you know, big guys, like you see in the Marine pictures on TV. John Wayne, you know, and Victor McLaughlin, Randolph Scott, them kind of guys. Not a punk like me, you know. And I was totally fascinated by these guys. And because they were new to me, this will certainly be no big deal to you people out here in the West and these cowboys sitting up here, but one of these guys was a real cowboy, and I had never seen a cowboy in my life, you know. I had never seen anybody on a horse in my life outside of a cop, you know. And here, this guy had an old cowboy hat, dirty one, you know, and a big thing, funny shirts and them big boots and... And while he was talking, telling us about riding the range, you know, and with the ropes, doing all of them things, then he made a cigarette with his mouth. Holy Christ! I had never seen anything like that, all with one hand, you know. And I watched in total amazement that he did that, you know. And I wanted to be him. Jesus, I wanted to be able to, you know, make one of them things. And ride the range, you know, and do the ropes and all of that. But I only wanted to be that, you know, until the next guy started to talk. And he was sort of a liar, you know. He first said he was in a circus. What he really was, he was a stagehand in a burlesque show that traveled around with a carnival. But his job allowed him to be backstage when the stripteasers got finished their act. Wow! That's no big deal today, you know, topless. In our permissive society today, it's nothing, you know. But in 1941, for a 16-year-old cherry, that was the deep throat of my day, you know. And I wanted to be him. I wanted to be him. And then later on, there was a merchant seaman there. It took me about 3 years to figure this out. He said he had lost his ship in New York. And many a night I'd laid, you know, trying to go to sleep. How the hell can you lose a ship in New York? Well, in order to escape whatever kind of punishment the maritime service was going to put out, he had enlisted that day under a fictitious name. in the Marines. And so these were the kind of guys that were on that train with me. And I wanted to be each one of them. I believe that's the beginning of the development of the alcoholic personality. Wanting to be somebody other than what I am. I believe that's the basic reason all of us have ever taken a drink. To effect a change. To effect a change. Now, I knew I was just a 16-year-old punk kid. I knew I wasn't a cowboy. I knew I wasn't in the circus, and I certainly knew I wasn't a merchant seaman. But I wanted to be all of those roles. Right now! They call that immediate gratification. I didn't want to wait to learn how to be it. I wanted it right now. And I didn't know how to do that. But obviously these guys did. Because we got a little friendly, and by the time the train pulled out of Penn Station and we got en route to Washington, D.C., our first layover, we had pooled whatever change we had amongst us together. And through some process, the eldest was picked to make a speed run into downtown Washington, D.C. And he got back on the train with a shopping bag full of booze. Now, I have no idea to this very day how much booze it was, what kind of booze. It really doesn't make a hell of a lot of difference. And that night I got drunk. That night I experienced my first introduction into the magic, the true magic of alcohol. I didn't have a convulsion. I didn't go into DTs. I didn't shoot a cop. I didn't do nothing horrible. I loved every damn minute of it. It was the greatest moment in my young life. It was fantastic. Because now I wasn't a 16-year-old snotty-ass, punk-ass, shit-ass little punk. I was one of the guys. And I walked into the dining car that evening, you know, and I sat right down and looked that waiter right in the eye and I said, "You know who I am?" And he said, "No." And I said, "I'm a rodeo star and I have just come back from Cheyenne, Wyoming, you know." And a little while later, I told a little old lady who didn't give a damn who the hell I was, you know. I told her I was an aerialist with the Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey Circus. Someone helped me into the berth that night. I told him I was the first mate on a ship that had just come back from Reykjavik, Iceland, you know. Man, I was jubilant. I had found the magic. I had found the magic. Now, we're told, you know, in our program that many times during our drinking careers, we are given a lot of warnings that alcohol and us are on a course of destruction, you know, and that for people like you and I, our lives would eventually become unmanageable. I, as many, never recognized these warning symptoms, and I continued to drink that night, and I certainly had a warning the very next morning. Let me tell you something, unless you've never been there. You would never believe where they take this train with the Marine recruits. You would never believe. I don't even know why they named that place, because there is nothing there. It doesn't even deserve a name. It would be an ideal testing spot for nuclear weapons, you know. It's a place called Port Royal, South Carolina. Oh, I guess the only reason they call it port related to water is that there's about 6 inches of water all around. It's a swamp. That's all the hell it is. A big swamp. And there is nothing there. No town. No USO. Nobody going, hey, you know. Boom. Just these tracks sticking up out of the water. And I don't know if they do this psychologically in the Marine Corps or not, but they bring you in there at 5 o'clock in the morning. And if you're an alcoholic, you know that's a hell of a time, you know. You don't know whether it's starting or ending, you know. And you know, I don't know what you call them trees. You nature lovers, surely these guys up here would know. They got all them trees that look like they're dead, you know, with all that crap hanging from them. You saw them in Gone with the Wind, you know, them kind of things. And they got things flying through there, and steam comes up off of it. It looks like where Dracula would hang out, you know, on Earth. And that's where I had to get off of the train, you know. And that's when I saw the first real Marine I was to see. I had only seen the other guys, you know, with the band uniform on, that white hat and all of that yard and a half of crap up here. And now I saw the first real Marine, you know. He was coming right out of that fog, you know. I would have been better off with Dracula, I tell you. This guy was about 5'8". And he was 5'8" every way you looked at him. He was 5'8", you know. He had no neck. His head came right out of his chest. Bright red, yeah. He had a Smokey the Bear hat. I looked like one of these guys around here, you know. Ooh. He carried a little stick under his arm, and he walked like he had a bad foot, you know, like, okay. And he came waddling up to me like a sick duck, you know, and he was from down one of them parts of the country where they talk funny, you know, in the southeastern part of the United States, Alabama, or something like, someplace that, you know, just don't understand style. Because I tell you how I was dressed, you know, 1941, I was dressed in what I thought was the style of my day for New York. I don't know what the hell the style was in Yosemite, you know. Pendleton shirts and leather hats, I guess. I don't know. But I had on, you know, I had a hat that had a brim way out to here. My pants were choked at the ankle, you know. Big knee like that. Belt line was up here someplace. My coat, they call them zoot suits, you know. Big roll collar, big chain down to here. Not standing there like that, you know. And Beetle Bailey is coming right at me, you know. Oh, you know. Just like he had smoke coming out of him. And in that accent that's familiar to that part of the United States, he just put his chin right up there with mine and started spitting all over my face and playing chinny chin chin, you know, and he says, "Well, I guess we got another one of them New York slickers. Here." Jesus Christ. That here was just like a big javelin, you know. Now, you know what alcoholic rage is. That's when you're... actions overrule your common sense, you know. And I struck out wildly, and I hit this guy, and that's not the way to enter any branch of the military, you know. And I spent the first 72 days of my Marine Corps career in the Paris Island brig, you know. But I only bring this out because I want to tell you a mistake I made in that brig that night. A mistake that I was going to continually make in my drinking career, and a mistake that any of you made in your drinking career. Now, I'm a 16-year-old kid. Bear with me for a moment and think. I'm going away from home for the first time in my life. I've severed family ties. There's no friends around. I don't know anybody. I'm in an entirely alien environment. Scared to death and I'm locked up. And I don't know what in the hell is going to happen to me. And I've got nobody to talk to. Now, my main thought was, what will they do with me? Now, there were a lot of people who could have answered that question who were knowledgeable enough to tell me. There was the sentry on duty. There was a guy called the corporal of the guard. There was a guy called the sergeant of the guard. There was a second lieutenant called the commander of the guard. There was a captain who was the officer of the day. And then there was a guy sitting at the desk called the brig warden. Any one of them guys could have told me what the hell was going to happen to me if I asked them. But you know who I asked? The jackass in the cell with me. I continually done that throughout my entire drinking career. Always asking some asshole who didn't know what the hell they were going to do. You've done the same thing. You got a heart murmur. You don't go to a doctor, you ask a bartender, right? Hey, what do you do? Got triple vision. What do you think of that? Triple vision, you know. And so this guy looked at me and he said, "Well, I don't know." He said, "What did you do?" So I related the little experience at the train and he said, "Uh-oh." He said, "Did the guy you hit have any stripes on his arms?" I said, "3. And he says, "You hit a non-commissioned officer." Well, that didn't mean anything to me. What the hell do I know, 16-year-old? I said, "So tell me what's going to happen." He says, "Well, striking a non-commissioned officer in the Marine Corps is punishable by a general court-martial." You know, what's a general court-martial? He says, "Well, some of the things that they can do as a result of a sentence of a general court-martial is they can hang you, shoot you with a firing squad or confine you to a naval prison for the remainder of your life. Those still are, to this very day, sentences of a general court-martial. Wow! Holy Toledo! I'm sitting in there in that cell crying my heart out, wondering what the hell is going on here. Outside, somebody's deciding whether to shoot me, hang me, put me in prison for the rest of my life. Where are you, mother, you know? And that night I said something that I said 1,000 other times, and so did you. I said, oh, God, get me out of this and I'll never do it again. And a few days later, I got out. But I didn't give God any credit for that. I thought it was because they figured I was a good shot. Looked like good material or something like that. Didn't want to waste any time in there. Well, shortly after that, the war broke out and Japanese took care of my drinking problem for a long time. So I didn't really have any drinking problem in the military. But when I came back, I had a drinking problem, a severe drinking problem. I didn't recognize it. I just thought I was a heavy drinker. And rather to insult you and bore you and relate to you blow by blow everything that happened to me as a result of my drinking would be rather embarrassing for me to do to you. I think what's more important, you know, is how we recover, why we recover, and what we do with our recovery. I could stand here, you know, and talk to you about prison and jails and institutions and skid rows and things like that. But, you know, that's how it happened. That's how it happened. It's important that I remember that. It's important I remember that. But like that little cartoon you see around sometimes that shows 5 or 6 guys standing around the quicksand pile, and it shows the jackass slowly sinking in the quicksand, all of a sudden one of them says, hey, the problem isn't how he got there. The problem is how are we going to get him out? How are we going to get him out? In the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about people like me and perhaps like some of you. I'm about to say something right now that's going to be rather hard and cold. But I say it only out of love because I think it's always necessary that we constantly and continually remind ourselves of just who we are and where we are. You know, our experience, and the young lady said it last night, you know, our experience tells us very sadly and tragically, you know, that perhaps everybody in this room here this morning is not finished drinking. You know, there are people, for reasons perhaps known only to them, who are going to drink again. Now, before you look askance at me and think that I've originated those thoughts, I refer you to the book Alcoholics Anonymous because that's where that thought comes from. And if you haven't had time to read the book, I'll quote it for you. It says, quote, despite all that we can say, many who are real alcoholics, by every form of self-deception and experimentation, will try to prove themselves the exception to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic. I was one of those people. I was one of those people. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. But let's take a look at the attempt, the pursuit, the illusion, the book says, the persistence in an illusion that somehow, some way, someday, I could again drink like a so-called normal person. Well, in that attempt to become a normal person, a normal drinker, you and I know that as alcoholics, in that attempt, we will literally put our lives right up on the line. People will die as a result of trying to become a normal drinker. People will lose their families as a result of trying to be a normal drinker. Jobs, careers, education, all of this stuff that's referred to as pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization is destined to take place in an attempt to become a normal drinker. And you know the sheer insidiousness of that? Is that there's not an alcoholic on the face of this earth who could tolerate for more than 3 seconds the conditions surrounding normal drinking? Or have you forgotten how normal drinkers drink? Watch them sometime. I watched some over in that moon place there last night. Moon Lounge or whatever they call it, you know. They go out and leave half of a drink on the bar. Good night. Oh, jeez. They say their damnedest things. I've had enough. No thanks. Two's it for me. Let's have a drink. They put caps back on bottles. They say, let's eat. Horrible, horrible, horrible. It's good that we can laugh at ourselves, you know. But it's tragic at the same time because you and I know that there are people in this room that are going to make that attempt. Make that attempt to be a normal drinker. Good God, how monotonous that would be to be a normal drinker. You know, I want to share something with you. I just thought of it as I said, normal drinker. It's a feeling that I have, you know. First off, I should explain a little bit about it or hold it off for a little bit because I want to tell you one of the mistakes that I made in the beginning. You know, I have tried, you know, all the time I've been in AA to maintain, you know, strict adherence to the principles, the concepts, and the steps of this program. And in the first 6 years that I was here, I also thought I was doing that. But a guy told me after 6 years, you know, he said, look, you're still drunk. And I said, well, I don't know what the hell is wrong, Harry. I says, you know, I think I'm doing everything. I said, I've been around AA now for 6 years. And that's when he says, hold it. He said, what did you just say? And I said, well, I don't know. I said, I've been around. He says, hold it. I have been around. He says, that's your problem. And I didn't quite understand what he meant. He says, you're still drinking because you are not a participant. He says, you have been around AA. You have to be in AA. Now, I thought of that this morning. As a matter of fact, I thought about that as I was driving over here from Monterey. I don't live in Monterey, don't get me wrong there. I live in the Napa Valley in the wine country. But that's, I can say that. They don't have anything like, I used to drink that Pride of Lodi. And they don't have that in Napa, I'll tell you that. I live in a little town called Calistoga, a little town that looks like where Tom Sawyer would live. Nothing exciting in our town except when one of the women members of our group gets drunk. Then everybody went to 12-stepper, you know. But I was thinking about it as I was driving up this 140, you know, and I began to feel Western, you know, and I stopped at some place, a miner's inn or something, to have lunch or something, and I wanted to buy one of them old hats, you know, and I was really getting in the mood, and I'm driving through the canyons here and all of that, and I expect to see the Indians coming any minute, and pew, you know. And then I thought of this little incident, which I have told people about on occasions, of the difference of being in AA and being around AA. You know, after this meeting, go out there and take a look at what's around us, and you almost have to marvel. Or it's just almost impossible to believe that our forefathers, you know, came out here through stuff like this. You know, and hell, they didn't have Jeeps and Land Rovers and crap like that. Man, they come out in them wagons, you know. And what a breed they must have been. What a breed they must have been. And as I thought of that, I thought of this comparison, you know. You know, when the people came west out here to settle this great state, most of them were getting kicked out, literally, out of other places. Getting kicked out of Ohio, Mississippi, you know. Couldn't find jobs. They weren't the best people in the world, you know. They had to move on. And I guess, you know, maybe someplace like Chillicothe, Ohio, 1 week, a whole bunch of them got thrown out. You know, get out of here, get out of here. And so they were all muddled around the town square there trying to figure out where in the hell to go. Somebody said, hey, let's go to that place called California. Here it's great out there, man. They got the Raiders, the Rams, and all the 49ers. So they said, yeah, everybody wants to go. Let's be down here Monday morning and we'll shove off. And then about that time, somebody said, anybody know how to get there? Second moment of silence. Nobody knew how to get there. Then some guy piped up. He says, well, he says, I was looking in the yellow pages in the book the other day. And he says, underneath wagon trains. He says, a number there, listen, Ward Bond. It says, Ward Bond. So they call up Ward Bond, you know, and old Ward come down to see them, and he told him, yeah, I've been out there a lot. He says, I'll take this out. He says, but I want this all down here Monday, 8 o'clock sharp, because we'll leave then, and but you got to understand this. If I'm going to take this wagon train out here, I am the boss. I am the man. You've got to do what I tell you to do. Follow my directions. And then he said something that was going to become immortal. And somebody said, well, why should we do that, Ward? Ward says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed my path. So Tuesday morning, they all assemble down there in the village commons, you know, and all these big wagon trains and the oxes and the oxens and the pails hanging from the side, you know, and all that kind of crap. And Ward counting them all, you know, here, there. And he says, okay, we're all ready to go. I'll give you a little signal, then you all follow me, you know. And he says, we got a little extra break this morning. I got my friend Frank Lane over here. Frank gave him a couple of bars of mule train, you know. Then Ward went, whoa, and off they went, you know, clippity-clop, 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 you know. And they went through Ohio, clippity-clop, clippity, and through Illinois, Nebraska, Wyoming, and clip-clop, clip-clop, whoa, and all that kind of crap. And then after many days, they arrived in Nevada, Winnemucca, Winnemucca, Nevada. And old Ward went, oh, put his hand up like that. And Frankie went, oh, and everything stopped, you know. And Ward says, I got to tell you something. He says, we're in Nevada. Bad scene, bad scene. He says, we could expect some problems here. He says, I'll tell you what I want you to do. He says, we got this far safe. You all been doing what I tell you to do. So tonight I want you to put all of the wagons in a big circle. Great big circle. And all of you people that want to be part of this new adventure, and all that want to be safe, you get inside of the circle. And so, clippity-clop, clippity-clop, they put all these big wagons, all that kind of crap, and made the big circle, and everybody got inside the circle. And then night came to the desert, you know. The whippoorwills whippled, you know. Home on the range. Purple sage, you know, all of that guy. It looked like a Hallmark greeting card, you know. And as the sun settled below the horizon, peace reigned. And then all of a sudden, somebody lit up a cigarette. And Ward Bond hollered, put out that damn cigarette, you can see it for miles. Guy says, screw you, Ward, I want to smoke. If you want to smoke, get the hell out of that circle. This guy picked up his bedroll and his blanket, and down the road he went a little bit and fixed himself up a little place, and he was short of cigarettes, too. And then night came back to the desert, and the whippoorwills, and the purple sage, and peace reigned. Then all of a sudden, somebody started playing a banjo. And Ward says, knock off playing that banjo. I said, screw you, Ward. Out. And you two over there, out. A little slow in the morning, ain't you? They were playing Trivial Pursuit. So they all got outside of the circle. And then night came back to the desert. And the whippoorwills whipple. And it looked so nice, you know. There was the wagon train, you know. Hallmark greeting card. and peace came to the desert. And about that time, you looked up on the mesa. And up there in their pintos was Cochise and Sitting Bull. And they were looking down at the Hallmark greeting card, you know. And Sitting Bull said to Cochise, he said, "Co." Co says, "What do you want, Bull?" He says, "Look like Ward Bond got one of them wagon trains down here again." He says, "Yeah, that's his style down here. Put them all in a circle, Co." Co says, "Jesus Christ, came all the way over here for nothing. Well, maybe on the way back we'll stop off at Bighorn and see where that asshole Custer's doing." So they got ready to leave, and all of a sudden Bull said, "Hey, Co, hold it." Co says, "What's up, Bull?" Co says, "Look over there, Co." Co says, "Where, Bull?" "He's off there to the left." And Co says, "I gotcha. He's that guy over there smoking." Bull says, "You got him. Looking way over there. Look at the guy with the banjo." Bull says, "Got him. Oh, Jesus, look at them two over there." He says, "Well, we don't have to go home empty-handed." And down off the mesa they came, you know. And they got the guy with the cigarettes, got the guy with the banjo, and they got two over there in the corner playing Trivial Pursuit, you know. Because they were all around the circle. The people who were in the circle went on to California. Simple moral to that story. In or out. In or out. In you're safe. Out you're not safe. And so I had to get in to this program. You know, this is a terrific experience, and I know there's a lot of new people here tonight. What you're experiencing this weekend, because I'm going to tell you something that I don't know how to say it, really. I don't want you to believe it, but understand it. And it doesn't apply to you if you're real new. Now, that sounds sort of weird, but you'll know what I mean. You know, I've been here for a while, and really, if my sobriety, if the change in my life as a result of not drinking was nothing more than 3 or 4 nights a week, I was going to some church basement to drink that crummy coffee and eat them lousy cookies and listen to our crap over and over again, I really believe I would make a choice to go back to drinking. You see, I didn't stop drinking to wind up in church basements eating cookies. I have been an action guy all of my life. Bill Wilson said that this was a program designed for a new way of life for people who chose not to drink. That's what I wanted. I wanted a new way of life. I wanted to live. I wanted to experience. I wanted to be without drinking. And then I discovered Yosemite's. I discovered Palm Springs. I discovered Monterey's. Or I discovered any of these so-called activities that take away that attitude that sobriety is a punishment or a penance. Because for them first few years, there were times when I sat in meetings wanting to scream, you know. Full of that self-pity, full of that thought of the Peggy Lee song, "Is this all there is? You know, is this what I have to resign myself to?" But then I found out that this other part of AA exists. That it is possible to mix, you know, a couple of laughs with the seriousness of sobriety and the fellowship and the sharing and all of these things. So reach out for this. I always call it the gusto, you know. I never knew how to explain that. You know, because I knew why I didn't drink anymore, but I just didn't know how to tell people. They'd say, "Why don't you drink anymore?" And it wasn't because I'm an alcoholic, because I drank plenty when I was an alcoholic, you know. And I knew in my gut, but I just didn't know how to say it. And then I'll tell you what happened, and I hope I don't offend any. Well, it's tough if I do, you know. Some years ago, I was in Stockton. Let's face it. Now, come on. Stockton is not the Riviera, you know? About the most exciting thing you can do in Stockton. You know, it's like being in an empty paint can, you know? Best shot you get on Saturday is to go through the J.C. Penney store a couple of times. Look at work clothes, you know. Well, I was sitting in the motel this afternoon, you know, trying to kill some time till the evening's activities. And I was watching one of them Saturday afternoon classics on TV, you know. Godzilla rapes Shirley Temple or something like that. And during one of the commercial breaks, a commercial came on. And I know many of you have seen it. As a matter of fact, it was filmed right in San Francisco Bay. And it was filmed on one of them glorious days that they have there, you know, one of those warm days and all the sailboats are out on the bay. Look like a bunch of little butterflies flicking around out there, you know. Just looks nice. And on these sailing schooners, you know, they, all the guys, young fellas, 20, 21 years old with funny little hats and weird t-shirts and cut-off blue jeans were just jackassing around on them, you know. And they zoomed in on one of these ships and showed the guys swinging on their lines and dropping into the bay and diving off of the mast, just having a hell of a time. And then the punchline came on. Said, you only go around once. Grab all of the gusto you can. And I didn't know what the hell gusto meant, you know. And so I looked it up in the dictionary. And it says, you only go around once, grab all of the gusto. Gusto is a slang expression for the word living. You only go around once, grab all of the living you can. And only a total idiot would sit in this room or any other room like this thinking that he or she is going to get more than one shot at this thing called life. Life's a one-time trip. Life's a continuing process. There's no putting life on hold. There's no saving some for later on. There's some very cold facts about life. Did you ever stop to think that from the moment it starts, it begins to get shorter? That's right. Every second, every minute, every unit of time that goes by is a part of your life that is over. Over. Done, finished, end 30. All done. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm quite sure that you would share in these thoughts. I want every bit of life there is. Hell, I want to go every place there is to go. I want to see everything there is to see. I want to read every book there is to read. I want to hear every song that's ever been sung. I want it all. There's nothing wrong with that. Except common sense tells me, of course, that, hey, come on, you can't get it all. But I know something else, and I'm quite sure you know it, too, because it's based on my experiences and your experiences being shared with each other, that I can get a hell of a lot more out of life if I'm not using and drinking than I ever got using and drinking, and that's why I don't drink today, because I want life, life. Let me tell you how I feel about this now. Not too long ago, and I apologize if this gets a little bit off of AA. It's not really off of AA, but it took place at a non-AA. I have, as I said before, tried to live by the traditions and the concepts of this program. Can't endorse or oppose any outside causes. You got to sit there and take a little lip once in a while and just smile and forgive them, you know. There's a word called stigma that's attached to the word alcoholic. And it's sad and tragic because that stigma has caused many of our brothers and sisters to forfeit their lives. It's hard perhaps for some of us to realize that there are people who chose to die rather than identify as an alcoholic. But you know how that is. And then there are the misinformed, the ignorant, who are out there who still belittle and berate you and I as alcoholics, you know. Some months ago, I was invited to participate in a non-AA activity in a place called Montpelier, Vermont. The only thing good about that whole weekend was I brought home 4 gallons of maple syrup. I left one of them in a goddamn airport, if I'm mistaken. But it was beautiful. Now you know why I got the belly. But anyhow, that started out to be one of the worst weekends of my life. Yes, from the minute it started on Friday, I was sort of the token alcoholic. All of the other people were psychiatrists, psychologists, and people of religious backgrounds, you know. And the entire weekend was going to be on alcoholism. And they had invited me just so I guess that people could see what one was, you know. And I sat there tolerating it because, quite honestly, I got $750 for that. So, you know, it's a pretty good deal for me. But paid for my season tickets next year for the Giants, so what the hell. But I sat there that whole weekend, you know, listening to them people knock me and knock you, you know, the same old cliches we've heard for years, the so-called lowly drunkards of the world, the outcasts of society, the scum of the earth, you know. Like the over in Ireland, they refer to us as the strange ones, you know. And people and ministers and... Oh, so many people have been belittling you and I, you know, and they get up there and blast out about how we're so weak-willed and we lack courage and all of that crap. And I've heard it for over 30 years. But that wasn't the day, I guess, for me, because that closing Sunday afternoon, we were all sitting at a table like this, about 14 people, a little name in front of you so they'd know who you were, you know. And they didn't have no name in front of me. I was supposed to be anonymous, you know. Big deal. And so everybody participated in this thing, and there was a minister was closing, and it doesn't make any difference what denomination he was, but he was closing this thing, and just before he closed it, he says, by the way, our friend from California, anything you'd like to say in closing? And what a mistake that was. My ass was red hot. It was puckering. And I said, yes, I says, there's a few things I'd like to say. And I can't quote it word for word. I sure wish I did, and I sure wish there had been a tape. Because at first, you know, I said this out of anger. And I said it out of resentment. And I wasn't really too sure what I was saying. But the more I've thought about it since, and it's almost a year ago now, the more stronger these are my beliefs today. They say that we are weak-willed. They say that you and I lack willpower. Our common answer to that used to be rather humorous. We say, if you think willpower works, try it the next time you have diarrhea. Ha, 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 we'd all laugh. But let's think for a minute. Alcoholics are supposed to be weak-willed, huh? Has there ever been a day or a time in your life when you wanted a drink that you didn't get it? Never. Nothing has ever denied me and you getting a drink when our will was so strong that we wanted it. They put me in prison to keep me from drinking. I drank more in prison than I did outside of prison. Where do you think Pruno was invented? By Robert Mondavi? Or who do you think discovered that if you took Griffin shoe polish and sifted it through a loaf of white bread, that you'd come out with a teaspoonful of alcohol? The House of Seagram's? And Coors sure as hell is not responsible for the discovery that you can take a can of Sterno Red Label and squeeze it through a t-shirt and come up with a beautiful elixir on the bottom of the t-shirt, you know. These were all discovered by men and probably women whose will was so strong to drink that nothing was going to deny them. Now, that might sound a little silly, but it's the truth. And a belief that I have that started out to be just sort of a funny is now reality to me, which exemplifies the strong will of the alcoholic coupled with the sheer ingenuity of the alcoholic. Because I believe if you took two alcoholics and handcuffed them together and tied them to a stake out in the middle of the Sahara Desert, that if these two guys came up with a desire to drink, it would only be a matter of time, and in a relatively short period of time, they'd discover a formula for distilling sand. I believe that. So we are not weak-willed. And they say we lack courage. Is that right? We lack courage? If you be alcoholic, as I am an alcoholic, obviously you reached a time in your life when alcohol was the most important thing in your life. I know that to be true because I know some of you on a more personal basis in this room this morning, and I have heard you attest to that truth. Because I've heard some of you say, Jesus Christ, give me a drink before I die. Convinced that you were going to die if you didn't get a drink. I'm not proud of the fact that my life finally arrived at a point like that. As a matter of fact, to a point where it was about the time between drinks was the extent of my life. About a 20-minute period was all that I would have faith or trust in. I lived from one drink to the next. My only concern, just as soon as I got a drink, was would I get another one in 20 minutes? Or would I die? Or would I die? Now, it's a time like that when we face what some people would call a dilemma. A dilemma, I have been told, is when you have opposite answers for the same question, but both answers are valid. Sort of sounds a little screwy, because how could you have opposites mean the same? Well, my example for that was when I had regressed to that point in my life where as an animal, and that's the only way I could describe myself on Chicago Skid Row, I would shuffle into a saloon in the morning, a place called Big Rothschild's, and I would just sit there at the bar because there was no need for communication anymore. The bartenders knew you and knew what and everything. 4 ounces of cheap wine for 15 cents was placed in a 7-ounce paper cup because that's the only thing you could hold in the turmoil of your stomach. And you know, alcoholics cry in the morning on Skid Row. Maybe some of you don't know that. Yeah, they always cry before they get their first drink. Yeah. They don't want anybody to know that. They don't want nobody to see that, but they all cry. You see, because that's the only time that day that you're forced to live in reality. And you know what you've become. And you know what you're becoming. And you know what you've caused to happen in the lives of those you love the most. And you sort of well up inside with self-disgust. And then the only release from that is a tear. But just as soon as you get a drink, it's all right because life begins to get better then. The answers begin to come clear now. But before it comes, you sit there and you look at that drink. And I used to look at it. And I knew that if I drank it, it would kill me. I knew that. If I drink it, it's going to kill me. But in the back of my head, something else was saying, but if you don't drink it, you're going to die. That's opposite answers for the same question. And both of them were valid. If I drink it, it kills me. If I don't drink it, I die. It's that time that I believe courage erupts in the lives of alcoholics like us. In most cases, the initiation to that kind of courage comes about and is introduced to you and I by a stranger, semi-stranger, who makes one of the most incredible suggestions you've ever heard. Why don't you do something about your drinking? Are you mad? What do you mean, quit drinking? If I quit, I'll die. And then he looks at you and says, oh yeah, I know. But that's not really true. And as you look at him, getting ready to rebuff him, you notice that his eyes are white, that his shirt is clean. And he smells all right. And there's a crease in his trousers and a shine on his shoes. And there's a color in his cheek that you envy. And you wonder, who the hell is he? How do you know? And then he says, because I was like you. And you look a little closer. And you begin to think almost obscene thoughts.
Could it be? Nah, he certainly couldn't have been like me. Boy, I sure would like to be like him. I don't want to be like this. I want to see my kids, but... And he nods his head and gives you a compassionate look and says, I know just how you feel. And you begin to wonder then, could I? Maybe. I wonder. And then at that moment, the alcoholic does something. He looks into the eyes of this guy. This guy he hardly knows. But when you look in his eyes, you don't see his eyes. There's like a place that only alcoholics can see in other alcoholics. It's like a little place that's behind the eye. And in there you see things that say hope and companionship, fellowship, understanding, compassion. And then this guy who is so sick, so full of fear, holding on to the only thing he's got left, his life. His life, that's all you had. And without any guarantee, without any promise, without any evidence that it's going to work, on nothing more than faith. Pure faith in another alcoholic. He lays gently into his hands his life. And that takes courage. That takes a kind of courage that I have never seen exhibited anyplace else in my life. And that courage eventually brings you and I and people like you and I to a point. To a point where we receive what is referred to as a gift. A gift called sobriety. And if there be any of you new in this room here this morning who are here seeking this gift, it abounds in this room this morning. It's all around you this morning. And it's here for the asking. That's all you need to do is to ask. Because it's going to take two of us. One will have to extend this gift. And the other will have to come forth and want it. And when you come in communion, as it happened with me, my sponsor placed into my hands this gift called sobriety. And as he laid it gently in my hands, he said these things to me. He said, Duff, there are conditions contingent upon this gift. I want you to take this gift and hold it close. Hold it close to you. And take from it all of the strength that you need. Take from it its understanding, its love, and its compassion. And he said, Duff, if you'll do that, sooner than you expect, and certainly much sooner than you deserve, you'll be able to stand up, and you'll be able to walk once more amongst your fellows. And on the day that you can do that, on the day that you can rise again and walk with some semblance of dignity, we ask you only to bring that gift back. Thank you very much for having me here.